what are we actually going to do today? Well, basically, it's going to be split up into four segments, okay? First of all, what is Communication Society? Not to be confused with CSI, because obviously that's a crime scene investigation, which we won't be doing at present, but there we are. Why do Communication Society? I mean, I'm always a great believer, and it's a big philosophical thing right from the start. Socrates was the first person who effectively started saying, why should we do this? You know, what's the purpose of it? Why should we give up, what, about 50 minutes of our valuable time when we could be spending it in Nando's or elsewhere or some other sort of bigger part, etc.? So why are we actually doing this? Is it a means to an end? Is it a way of actually kind of beginning to expand that, etc.? And what is the kind of context? You know, why, in terms of the sort of things that we're actually doing, as I sort of said at the beginning, does this really contextualise a lot of the current work that you'll be encountering, you'll be doing, and so on and so forth? It's not literally the end. It's just a case of concluding side of things from that point of view. So we'll just take that on a step-by-step basis. Okay, so let's start off with this key thing, and I'll give you a couple of other texts that could be quite worthwhile considering, etc. What do we actually mean by communication society? And probably the best thing to do with respect to this is to, again, break it down into fundamental notions of what is society and what is communication. One form of communication is doing what I'm doing now, which is oral communication. That's one of the reasons why we look at orality primarily. And if we were going way back to the days of Socrates and the Stoic philosophers and Zeno and various other sort of folks, etc., the last thing he would want you to do is to be taking notes. He'd say, put those pens down, put those laptops down, forget it. He would say, not good. He would basically say it wasn't good, because in an era of orality, where it's the spoken word that basically is the prime way of communicating, people need to remember what's being said. And actually, it wasn't until the print revolution of the Gutenberg press in the 1400s that we suddenly started actually having a permanent record of things. Now, that's not to say that writing wasn't around before that. Of course it was. The Sumerians, ancient Babylonians, there were ways in which clay tablets were sort of imprinted with various other bits and pieces. But even in the days of the ancient Greeks and the Romans, etc., it was quite a laborious task to actually commit material to paper. Monks used to do it quite effectively, and you can actually sort of do a calculation I'll talk about next week, where how many monk hours is actually spent in terms of putting together a particular book. But they would copy slavishly from the Bible, they would address all sorts of other areas. And one of the reasons why there was a concern about writing being not good was it was seen as basically creating lazy minds, because you'd forget things. Big word coming up now. Evanescence, E-V-A-N-E-S-C-E-N-C-E, Evanescence. Obviously a great rock band on the one hand, but anybody else know what evanescence actually means? It's the gradual fading from memory. The fact that even today, if I was to ask you, what did you do with Doug this morning? Give me a step-by-step, second-by-second account. Nobody would be able to do it. You kind of get general things there. You might be able to refer back to notes that you might have taken. You might have various other things as well. But by the time you actually get to, you know, end of the week, next month, next year, suddenly it all begins to blur. Think back. Can you remember? You might remember certain key points which are kind of imprinted on your mind, etc. First day at school, maybe. First day, you know, in a particular sporting success. What, any of those kind of things. But gradually, evanescence is the phenomenon of things gradually fading over time. And one of the ways in which people used to communicate effectively was through using things like music, ballads, songs, Homer's Iliad. Pages and pages of sort of detailed structure, etc. It's good to the Bible. There's lots of things there. So you're repeating, 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 repeating. And again, messages are put out from that point of view. Now, I'm not saying that it's great we've moved on from that. I'm not saying it's bad. These are kind of decisions that you need to look about. But it's ultimately about how do we communicate. Now, there is an argument which says, yeah, and now we're almost going back in full circle because we've got emojis, you know, hashtag smiley face, sad face. It's Blue Monday. It's supposed to be the most depressing Monday of the year.
What today?
Because basically it's still a long time before we actually sort of can see sort of the end of the month. Christmas is long gone. You know, there's also, and it's very depressing. You know, very sad. But it's how are those messages put about? How are they created? Are we looking at simple slogans? Are we looking at ways in which you can actually do effective marketing, do branding, approach those kind of systems? And it's also about how do we kind of make use of the technology as a portfolio, a portmanteau of approaches to kind of connect and get the messages to go. I mean, the biggest challenge as human beings that we're always faced with is how much of the message is being communicated? How much is being lost in interference, to other areas, etc.? And one of the roles of public relations specialists is to hopefully make sure that the message is quite clear. And it's using a number of theories. Maybe it's nudge theory. Maybe it's ways in which you are kind of gradually engaging with the community, with society, etc. All other sort of areas that, again, you look at with me in level two and various other factors. Well, there's another big word for you to do with respect to evanescence and so on. Communication can either be synchronic or diachronic. Every time you look at a book, you read something online as an e-book, or you read some of your own notes, in essence, you are traveling in a time machine. You are reading things which were written a period of time ago. When I first produced the slides for this, I kind of updated it, and I put various other bits and pieces on there, but you're looking at how things change. And a good example of this, if you think about either a movie you've watched, and you saw as a child, you saw Harry Potter, you know, you see Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone as an 8-9 year old, etc., see it 10 years later, etc., you come at it from different angles. You know, it brings with it a whole package of different sort of areas. So things tend to adjust over a period of time. That can be a year, can be 10 years, can be 10 centuries. You know, but the fact of the matter is things do change. It's the one undeniable fact of our existence as human beings. Things change. Usually for the better, sometimes more challenging, but they will inevitably actually change from that point of view onwards. So consider this as a question which, again, we'll go on to consider later in the session, etc. If we took away our mobiles, I mean, again, it's a usual line, and every so often you get people saying, how long could you go without one of these? You know, has it got everything, or a computer? How long could you actually sort of feel comfortable? Would it be because that's the end of everything? Or would you sort of suddenly start working through alternative processes to actually deal with that whole process? You know, if there was an electromagnetic pulse which literally just took out all technology. Yeah. Very frustrating. You know, most of the material that we do now, in fact, all the material when we set you assignments that are written, is all marked online. Great. But if the situation is the case 2-3 weeks ago when I was marking essays and stuff from the first semester, and it was taking like 45 minutes to download one essay. So I phone up to her computer, so it's a problem. Yeah, system problems all around, etc. You know, we get used to technology sorting into places from that point of view. But the key thing is that five-letter word there, or four-letter word if you wish, tool or tools. They're devices which we use, which we employ to hopefully facilitate our particular work, etc. As I say, it can be online, offline. One of the things I'll be doing with this, and hopefully we'll make this lecture as well available as a podcast so you can download it, so again you can listen again, sort of pick up various other sort of aspects within that. But fundamentally these are the kind of areas, and this, you know, well, the old classic, the pen is mightier than the sword, is something which is fairly critical. You know, if you get the sort of phrasing wrong, if you get the sort of choice, or maybe it's, it becomes a lot more simple, take back control, oven ready, etc., etc. Other sort of lines and terms that are actually being used often by politicians. And when we talk about politicians, maybe, just maybe, we actually start talking about that particular hierarchical structure. Because one of the key things that hopefully is at the heart of good education, it's certainly the reason I'm in the business and I'm hopefully we're translating that to you, is it gives you a sense of information and it gives you access to understanding, and ultimately knowledge is power. The more you know about particular things, the more you are better served. Now, it's true to say that nobody knows everything about everything. I mean, the last person supposedly was Erasmus. But in terms of actually understanding things and maybe realizing that the more you know, the less you know, actually, there are all sorts of other issues within that. But it also means that that knowledge power dynamic ties in with the whole notion of how do we see ourselves? How do other people see yourself as an undergraduate, as a graduate in a few years' time? How are things developing within that? How do you actually sort of, you know, again, position yourself within the area? I mean, so one of the great things, I keep on saying, I'm standard sort of line, but one of the great things about a small group like Public Relations and Communications is it's pretty much 100% guaranteed that assuming you actually do all the stuff within the course and work through that, you will have a choice of jobs in good areas when you graduate, if that's what you want. You know, it is actually there. You know, contrast that with students who take on English, where you might have 160, and we'll get English degrees at the end of it, fine, where do they actually go? There aren't that many spaces, so again, you've got an area within that. And also it helps build up that whole notion of understanding and having empathy with the challenges of communication. You know, whether you're speaking with cultural, cross-cultural communications, whether you're speaking about international aspects, how you actually get it, or even in terms of actually within, you know, the country itself, how do you actually relate that in terms of generational communications and areas within that, where, you know, if we look at cli-fi, the greatest buzzword for climate fiction, climate change, cli-fi, you know, where are we actually looking to in terms of how that is being developed? Greta Thunberg, who actually I found shares her birthday, the 3rd of January, with J.R.R. Tolkien and myself. How dare she? It's interesting. But anyway, in terms of that, messages, how that is actually put out, how it's developed, how do we actually address that, all connects together, sort of the four sort of aspects there, which you can interchange, to be honest. But they're all kind of at the heart of the sort of messages that we're about here and talking through. So, I kind of talked about some of the bedrock there. Let's look at this next question. Why? Why actually spend time really focusing in terms of what contemporary issues or indeed communication society is all about? I kind of was crossing over there with communication society. And why have I juxtaposed two images there? One of Daniel Radcliffe. Does he look young? And the other one, books being burnt. Okay, well. Yeah. And that particular manifestation, which goes all the way back to, well, actually way before the Nazis and the 30s, etc., but this whole notion of burning books, burning sort of particular things which you don't agree with, you know, Potter, or J.R. Rowling, I should say, fell foul of a particular viewpoint within Middle America that actually she was a practicing Satanist. What? You know? Another sort of, so obviously, you know, witchcraft is bad, it's Satan's work, etc. Ultimately, as is the case with a lot of these things, even the same way as, you know, the Third Reich would burn books, etc., and the classic line that was said by many a philosopher was, where you start burning books, pretty soon you start burning people, is this whole notion of being able to appreciate what is being said in terms of the entertainment side of things, what are the messages that are actually out there, and also coping with the, to be blunt, manure when it hits the fan. You know, when you, I mean, on the one hand, you could say, great, people are buying copies of Harry Potter books just to burn them, so sales are going through the roof. Again, interesting messages in terms of, you know, what is related to society and how we actually see that being developed, etc. So let's jump on to the whole notion of context, which is another sort of interesting line I want to sort of follow through. One of the things which certainly I saw a news story yesterday, which was particularly interesting, is how in the East Midlands in particular, there are supposed to be millions of pounds all set to be invested in the high street. Because obviously Jeff Bezos and Amazon and other internet servers effectively have substantially meant that more and more people are shopping online. The notion of obviously using your local shops, your local businesses, it's one of the reasons why, you know, in most cities, you're getting a kind of range of charity shops, betting shops, all sorts of other sort of areas, pop-up stores, etc., etc. But if you actually take that other line in terms of related to communication, obviously you've got financial transactions on the one hand, and then you've got the Vodafones, the EEs, the Carphone warehouses, the other sort of aspects, where they kind of slot into that other industry in terms of how you're relating to the store, the stand as well. I said we were crossing a few thousand years, etc., and we'll be filling this in terms of how things develop. I mean, it's not a historical aspect, although I think it's important to have a bit of a sense of history in terms of the way in which things operate from that point of view. But broadly speaking, there you've got five key elements that kind of relate to communication society. The Renaissance, which literally stands as rebirth, after the Dark Ages, you know, where in essence there were an awful lot of books being burnt, there were an awful lot of areas, there were a lot of areas that were being lost. There's the onset of medievalism, there was a lot of plague. You know, here at Lincoln, the cathedral was built, it collapsed, there was an earthquake, all sorts of things were happening, etc. Problems from that point of view. And then there was this gradual rediscovery of things that we kind of lost, that had kind of been put into place a thousand years earlier within the Greek culture. I mean, obviously one of the reasons for the Dark Ages was the fall of the Roman Empire. I suppose you could say that was Roman exit, really, back in the day. What did the Romans ever do for us? But in terms of that whole sequence, you know, clearly there was a departure, there was a change, and it took time to reset the whole system. But this particular date here, or that particular thing, which is around about 1470, anybody know what might have been happening about 1470, which really kind of triggered off the Reformation, the Scientific Revolution, and the Age of Enlightenment, and arguably the Industrial Revolution? I mentioned it once earlier. A gentleman called G. Rather, his second name began with G. His first name was Johannes. And he actually had several businesses that he tried to succeed, including actually selling fake medicines, until he realised that wasn't working. So he finally found this thing called printing, and his name was Gutenberg. Johannes Gutenberg first came up with the whole notion of the printing press. Now, one of the things about printing is it speeds up the way in which information can be disseminated through society. You know, if you can replicate stuff, you can suddenly get messages out there, you can get political slogans out there, you can get campaigns out there. You can, as Martin Luther did, pin up on the wall of a cathedral in Germany his protestation against the ruling of the Catholic Church, etc. You can get this whole notion of the Reformation. But in addition to that, you can also get other things being developed. And you get names like Nicholas Copernicus, Polish astronomer, Galileo Galilei, the Italian astronomer, one of whom was eventually excommunicated, Galileo, and the other one was kind of allowed to continue. Why was Galileo excommunicated? Because he dared to suggest that the Earth actually revolved around the Sun, as opposed to the Sun revolving around the Earth. That was heresy. You know, it was absolutely, you know, how can you take away all the privilege of society? You can't be allowed to spread those ideas. And that is, again, one of the big challenges about print. It enables ideas to be disseminated. It enables them to be tested. It actually opens up a whole range of other factors. If you are in the area of medicine, in the pre-1400s, you might have one or two or a number of herbal remedies that might actually cure the ague, the Black Death, bubonic plague, but it may be 50-50. And if you're only basically using that whole notion of a hierarchical structure where only the very elite in society can actually translate the deep runes and the whole range of challenges which are within that to actually deconstruct what's being said, you've got power gains. We still have a world, sadly, in which there are large numbers of the globe who suffer from illiteracy, from innumeracy, and so on. one of the things about being literate and actually being able to understand things is actually not having that concentration of knowledge. I mean, again, if you were in the church at the time, only the priests and possibly some of the senior monks would actually understand or be able to actually read the biblical teachings, etc. And you'd get into a whole range of things there, which would be, again, used to control aspects of society and so on. But if you're getting lines such as the notion of maybe science is a way of operating which can open up a whole variety of changes as well, you get into this whole notion of scientific revolutions, and you can test them, because other scientists, once you master the art of reading and it's been printed, you can test various other things, you can start beginning to see how things are growing as well. This then leads on to the whole essence of the Age of Enlightenment, often regarded very much as the precursor to the modern society that we live in today, 400 or so years later, and of course the first industrial revolution. I say the first because there is a lot of debate about whether we're right in the middle of a second huge change now in terms of the information revolution and the IT age and the era which, depending on your viewpoint, depending on your perspective, can actually have as revolutionary impact on society as the Industrial Revolution had in actually shifting from a rural, agrarian economy that was set very much within the countryside into a kind of concentrated town, mass production based things, for all the challenges obviously that that falls into place with. So, printing press 1475, thereabouts, and yet, there's a gap of about 950 years between the first printing press and the advent of the very first newspapers. Speed of change is moving quicker and quicker, some might say. But again, it took quite a time to actually gradually work to that particular element and work through. And that's not a print newspaper as we understand them today. It's very much a case of perhaps one, two sheets which would be disseminated and worked through from that point of view. What's the significance of a newspaper? It's mass communications. It's the first time you can actually look at, you know, you can print something and your views can basically go out to thousands of people, or however many people actually want to buy a copy of your newspaper. You're getting people actually involved and engaged with from that point of view. 100 years later, people realizing that people want more than just information. So let's actually consider the whole notion of the novel, which obviously J.K. Rowling can then have burned a few hundred years later. But the way in which, you know, novel writing can be developed, and again, you know, 1815, so 200 years, 205 years ago, was the onset of the first publication of what many people would say was the first science fiction novel ever produced, written by Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. So, as we can see in terms of the lines from that sort of system, you're gradually... Now, the importance of this is it's a linear progression. Now, that doesn't mean to say everything. This happened, because history is more than just a set of dates. Never go away, and hopefully you don't go away today thinking, oh, that happened. Because, again, you often have to look at what's happening in the culture at the time to actually start determining why that's there. So, again, we're looking at the context of why this is actually important and how this is being developed and structured and so on. And for every kind of, we're a bit like life. Two steps forward, three steps back. Three steps forward, two steps back. You know, slow steps. You know, there's never going to be a sort of a, find that there are certain eureka moments where you think, oh, yes, that's it. But again, you're always looking at how things are growing and developing from that point of view onwards. Okay, talked about some of the theorists and some of the people who you will possibly be engaging with or encountering. We'll hopefully have a listen to one of them in a few moments to actually have a flavour of this. And there is one gentleman who is kind of at the heart of a whole range of key things. Second part of the 20th century in particular, his name, you won't be able to read from that side, is Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan, who's possibly two key things, and we go on to talk about McLuhan later on, certainly when we talk about the internet and so on, because you could argue that he, he really predicted a lot of stuff with respect to that. The first of his concepts related to the global village. The fact that actually media, and when he was writing, the mass media were radio, print, television and film, all of which we'll kind of look at in terms of how they develop before we get into social media and so on. But from the point of view of McLuhan, they were shrinking the time that we actually had. You know, people could actually know what was happening in Australia almost as soon as it's happening. We know that they've been faced with fires, they've now had hailstones, had hailstorms, etc., etc. You know, we know this. We can kind of get a global sense of what's happening. We can go online, we can see what's happening now if you wanted to. We can connect. I mean, time in Australia at this time is probably around about 11 p.m., so possibly midnight, etc., so again, time. But, you know, we're still actually existing in that global village. And the sense of a village has its roots in that village community of people knowing basically what is going on in this house down the street or the road down there, etc., the village community. He also goes on to talk about the medium being the message. The sense actually that the choice of medium that is selected is very much determined by its appropriateness, by how things are developed, by what's suitable, and so on. Sometimes, if you're into orality, you would say, well, obviously radio audio is a one fantastic medium to actually use. Podcasts these days will be used from that point of view. But again, there might be other times where you're looking at print. Maybe you're looking at a kind of combination of different areas as well. There we are, Marshall McLuhan. Gentlemen, again, we cover more in depth in the second year, but it's worth noting now because he does have a significant number of things to actually say. He's sort of past his 100th year these days. Jürgen Habermas, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-S-S. Habermas was somebody who was a member of the Hitler Youth. In terms of why he was so concerned to actually start post-war appreciating the importance of communications, was he could not understand how the country had been suckered into this offensive, deeply divisive element of existence. And so he spent a large number of years in his later life, etc., working to begin to unpick that. And he talks about communications in the public sphere. He talks about providing platforms in which people can actually engage with the public sphere. He starts talking about what do we mean by the public sphere and how you can actually start beginning to deconstruct things in a way which hopefully means you would never get a repetition of simply, say, one particular party working through its own lines, etc. Chat we'll be looking at in more detail next week, although we might have time just to have a quick listen to a few thoughts that he sort of comes up with at this particular stage. Walter Ong, O-N-G, Walter Ong. And again, his line is very much this whole notion of orality and some of the strengths of orality. And again, I've put up on Blackboard something we'll hopefully have a chance to have a quick listen to, some of his thoughts, just a short 10-minute piece about how this has been developed and how it still actually is a significant part of where things are happening and so on. And because actually I quite like putting chickens in, for John Kerry, he doesn't really look like that, but still, what the hell. We'll talk more about John Kerry and his connection with that in the near future. Okay, has anybody got any questions so far about what I've sort of outlined, because what I've tried to do is just give you an opening to those the sort of first few weeks, really, to take us up to reading week about some of the key things that are actually there. All fairly straightforward. Obviously, all these things are on Blackboard, so sort of. Okay, let's go to consider this next little line here, which is Walter himself. I'll let him talk a little bit about the importance of oral cultures.
Well, let's go all the way back to the beginning, to the time before there was any writing at all. Now, this is very difficult for us to imagine, but oral culture is like, a totally oral culture, where nobody can write and nobody has even thought of the possibility of writing. In a culture like this, remember, nobody has ever looked up anything. When anybody was born, when anybody died, what belongs to whom, when anything happened. In fact, they don't have the idea of looking up. See, remember to say it, to look up something, that means you know how to read and write. All they can do is recall. They can just say it again. See, in Homer's Iliad, which after all is a poem for entertainment, there are over 400 lines which give you the names and number of followers of the Greek, of the captains of the various Greek ships. This is like the city directory. But you couldn't look these up. They couldn't write. If you wanted to hear them, you had to bring in one of these singers and have them sing them to you. He had to recall. In that kind of culture, in which maybe most of the world still lives, more or less, in that kind of culture, if you don't know something, you ask somebody. If he doesn't know, you maybe ask somebody else. When you run out of people to ask, that's the end. Nobody knows. There's no way to find out anymore until you become literate, and then you work back and figure it out a little bit, some of it anyhow. In this kind of culture, you cannot have any kind of scientific treatise. You cannot talk like I'm talking. There's no way, for instance, to have, nobody has ever given any kind of treatise, produced any kind of treatise on medicine. There's no way to do it. Imagine a treatise, all you could do would be to stand up and recite a book. Nobody can do that. What do you have? The closest thing you can get to a treatise in that kind of culture is a series of aphorisms. Feed a cold and starve a fever. The early bird gets the worm. Ars longaveter breaks. If the Longfellow puts it in his not too good poem, art is long and time is fleeting. That's the first aphorism of Hippocrates. That's the earliest medical writing we have in the West. And it's a series of aphorisms. All you've got is sayings. You can't make a list of them. Nobody can remember them in the right order. Remember, don't forget that in oral cultures, although these people have fantastic memories, it's never verbatim. No oral culture in the whole world, so far as we can tell by a massive survey, that can recite a thing, say, as long as the Nicene Creed verbatim. Absolutely incapable of it. They can tell you the story accurately, they can use formulas, but every time they tell it, it'll be a little bit different. So, when you get writing, something happens. Once you get writing, you can write a thing that we would call a treatise, something like Aristotle's Art of Rhetoric, which is a scientific approach to oratory. What can you say about oratory scientifically, about communication, for persuasion, scientifically? He puts it down. Well, you can write a treatise on medicine, or a treatise on forest trees. But this means that when this kind of treatise is composed, this is a completely new experience for the human mind. No human mind had ever gone through that kind of motion, where you show that this is due to this, and this is due to this, and this is due to these three factors, and each of those are due to these four others. You can't do that in normal culture. You can't get them lined up like that. You can't have this linear or causative development to any extent. You can get a little bit. You say, he pushed me and I fell over. Well, that's causality, but you can't construct a link of more than two or three chains and retain it. A chain of more than two or three links and retain the connections in your mind. So that these scientific type treatises, the kind of writing that we normally do, were a completely new experience of human mind. Nobody had ever thought those thoughts. But then once they had thought them, and thought them out and written them down, what happened to speech? When people invented writing, did they stop talking? Of course not. First of all, the people who invented writing were the ones who talked most. Writing was invented by people in urban settings, not the nomadic hunters or their herdsmen or the farmers, but people who lived in urban settings. It was really invented not at all for literary purposes in the aesthetic sense of that.
Okay, so a few points that he's actually made there. In that sort of opening 5 minutes, talks about the change of mindset. We talk about a paradigmatic shift. Paradigm is a way of thinking, P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M. And if you're sort of shifting that paradigm into a way that kind of makes you think about things in a different way. I mean, he talks again about the way in which, you know, academically people will be challenged verbally. You've had the onset of the adversarial system where you have two opposing points of view, and then a decision is made, a judgment is actually rendered in terms of what the situation happens to be. Certainly one of the reasons for the development of print culture and a writing culture was to actually get away from disputes. Because what is one of the challenges that you've got if you've got an oral culture? He said, she said. She said so-and-so, he said so-and-so. Who's what? You know, how do you need that sort of witness plus more to actually work through that. Whereas if you've actually got a contract that's been signed, and even if it's with an X or just marked and there's been a contractual line of things there, then you've got more of an opportunity of actually having evidence of work that's been put together. Now, the flip side, of course, of this, and one of the reasons why some of the images that you might have seen on there, it's there, obviously, to look at in all the time of Native Americans and so on, is that if you're shifting into a culture which primarily doesn't have experience of print and actually would pretty much steer well away from print, you can have all sorts of potential exploitations taking place. Hence the reason Manhattan was born, was bought for a handful of beads and I think about $15 or so. Not the base sort of, I mean, great real investment stake from that point of view, but again, challenges in terms of how you develop that side of things. So what I'm kind of leaving you with today is the notion that oral culture has its strengths. It has its strengths certainly in terms of remembering, and when we start talking about learning things by rote, actually understanding within that. I mean, it is one of the areas where if we are in an environment, which clearly are, where literally information is at the tip of our fingertips, you know, we can actually click a couple of buttons to find, then it's important to either use that, but use it as a tool and use it as a way to support arguments rather than just to replace them and substitute for them. And the other point that he made, which I think is worthwhile focusing on, again, we'll talk more about this next time, is how printing emerged as a kind of top-down model. You know, it's people who already were relatively sophisticated who actually started developing that whole thing. That's interesting, obviously, you know, last 30 years, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, they dropped out of college, they made a whole range of things, they've developed entrepreneurs things, and obviously we know now, the case of Gates, you know, the curse of seeing the little blue circle going round and round whilst updates are working through the process, etc., etc. You know, that's part and parcel of the change and the impact that it's actually used. You know, in your lifetimes, the likelihood is that wearables, where basically you don't have the separate identities, your iPhones, your updates and various other things. Updates and various other things. Apologies for this. It's a range of things that's happening from a program I'm producing on Wednesday, all about science fiction, etc. So it's colleagues there, so what they're going to talk about, etc., etc. And even that, it's a case of, whoa, so that's sort of coming through. So let's actually just work our way through that whole process of an online discussion that's taking place. And suddenly it's a case of, fine, that's useful, but just shut up. I can't, you know, there's information overload. You kind of almost have to select the key things that you want to use. Use them and develop it from that point of perspective. And that is also at the heart of this particular module. It's using the skill of discernment. Using a sort of area where you can select things that are appropriate and, to be quite brutal, say the right thing or write the right thing at the right time and the right place. Sometimes it's easier said than done, but ultimately that's certainly one of the skill sets that you need to look at in terms of how these things are developed and so on. So in terms of summarising the sort of key things that we've got from that particular perspective, we have clearly jumped through a whole range of sort of human experiences so far. What we'll do over the next few weeks is we'll take areas like Ong's orality, The whole essence, I mean, again, if you wanted to actually jump ahead, you don't have to, but it's just a case of that. I'll talk more about this, obviously, on Thursday. There's certain preparations. We'll talk about print. We'll talk about future print. We'll talk about radio. We'll talk about how that's developed, mass media, and so on and so forth. And I've given you various preparations from that as well. But it is very much a case of how, within the sort of title of Communication Society, can you actually select the most appropriate things to use? Why would you use them? How are they significant? And how can they actually develop from that point of view onwards? We next speak again.